and welcome to the Clever Tax Podcast, Creating Useful People. I'm Jodie Cook, and today I'm joined by an entrepreneur who's created some very useful things. So a big welcome to Jordan Dakin, the CEO of Gripit. Gripit is a £20 million business with a team of 50 and products that they export to 34 countries worldwide. Jordan successfully secured investment on Dragon's Den at the age of 18, making him the youngest contestant ever to do so. Deborah Meaden's investment in Gripit is now regarded as one of the most successful investments in Dragon's Den history. So welcome to the show, Jordan.
Hi, Jodie. Thanks for having me.
Jordan, you invented Gripit with your granddad when you were 13. But what I was even more interested to learn is that this wasn't even your first business. So can you tell us a little bit more about your very first venture?
Yeah, sure. So my first business was called RS2 Services. So basically, when I was a kid, I think it was about the age of 12, I used to play a game online called RuneScape. It's still around now. It's just some popular like war game, really. And basically in the game, you can buy things with real money that kind of it's virtual currency on the game. So you can like buy extra things and get basically improve your account on the game. So I used to do that and spend quite a lot of my pocket money doing buying extra stuff on the game. And so was all my friends at school. And I thought, well, hang on a minute, this is crazy. I'm spending so much money, and so are they, from the same supplier in China on their website. So I approached the company in China and said, if I bought from you in bulk, could I get a discount? So they gave me 50% off if I bought in bulk. And then basically I went onto YouTube and learned how to create my own website and set up the first business, really. And to begin with, I was just selling to family and friends, and then it kind of grew from there onwards.
How old were you at the time?
12.
So how does a 12-year-old know how to get in touch with a supplier in China and negotiate a bulk discount?
Well, it kind of just happened, really. It was weird. My dad and my granddad have always had their own businesses, and as I was growing up, I've kind of been brought up around it. So I kind of knew that to make money on something, you'd have to buy it cheaper sort of thing. And I was already buying from the Chinese supplier, but from their website at retail prices. So I just said to them, look, if I'm only buying, I don't know, £20 worth, but if I spent £200, can I get it cheaper, basically? And that's how it kind of started.
So what businesses did your dad and your granddad have when you were growing up?
Well, granddad was actually retired. He died in 1990 and I was born in 1995. When I was growing up, he always used to tell me stories of his businesses, and because he used to have a large chemical company in the Southwest. So he used to talk about all the different things and challenges he had, which I used to kind of find quite interesting when I was younger. And then my dad basically used to paint telephone boxes when I was a child. And then he was out of work for a while because they stopped making telephone boxes. And then basically went to the paper and just circled any job he could find, which was labouring down at the docks in Bristol, fitting leather seats. He started off there when I was really young. And then the guy he worked for went bust and he got asked to take on the contract there. So he started a business there and grew that to about 200 people. And that was kind of whilst I was growing up. So whilst he was doing that, he had an MOT car garage shop. So when I was young, I used to go into work with him and spend time behind the tills sort of thing. And yeah, so I kind of was always kind of growing up around like numbers and selling things. And
so when you were growing up, did you have a clear picture of what work meant to you and the people around you?
I think it was just going to be work for me. When I was younger, I always just looked quite hard. My dad always used to drill into me like school's like the easiest part of your life, even though I kept, when I was young, kind of going, I don't want to be at school, because he used to always be at work to provide for family. So I knew it was kind of work just seemed to be a hard, hard piece of life sort of thing.
So has your impression of work changed now from what it was then?
No, it is definitely harder. And I think I find myself saying to like my nephews and that, oh, you know, you don't know how lucky you are being at school still. So, which is funny, because I can remember being a kid thinking, I don't know what you're talking about. I just want to finish. I don't mind working sort of thing. But no, I'm the one saying it.
So school then, talk to me about your experience of school and the sort of education system.
I actually left school at 13, so I left school really early. I had quite a normal, I'd say, kind of up to year six, so like primary level education. That was really good. And then I ended up moving to the secondary school, and it kind of went wrong for me, where I ended up getting bullied, but not actually by pupils, more of actually the teachers.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was a really odd one, because I was on like the larger side as a kid. If there's any like pushes in the lunch queues or anything like that, it would be me and another girl who would get picked on sort of thing. And it kind of got worse and worse from that, with one in particular teacher, so I ended up leaving in the end.
So aside from the teachers who you didn't like, and it sounds like weren't very nice to you, were there any teachers that stood out for you as like in a good way?
Yeah, so from the primary school, there's a teacher called Stuart Morgan Nash, who was my tutor for year 5 and 6, and also our like science and maths teacher. He was kind of one who stood out and always kind of, he pushed me. He knew that I can get quite lazy, so he always used to set me tasks above my ability, just so he knew that it would challenge me, because I needed to be challenged really, so that I'd be interested and keep interested. And yeah, I still see him now.
So were science and maths your favourite subjects?
It was, but I think it was more to do with the teacher really, because he made it more fun and interesting for me rather than just another lesson at school.
So what were your least favourite subjects?
Probably things like music, religious studies. It just got just ones that kind of, because at the time I did well, and I never really thought it was going to do anything for me, so I kind of thought, well, why am I wasting my time as a kid doing that? But then there was kids in my year that loved it, so I think it's all each to their own really. I also quite liked art and like design and technology, because I like kind of creating things.
So if it hadn't been for the kind of teachers not being very nice to you, do you think you would have stayed in school?
Probably would have, yeah, because I think my dad and obviously they were always kind of saying you have to get a good education. My granddad always used to say to me, business is good, but every month can be a different kind of income, and you've got to make sure the sales keep coming in. So he was kind of saying to me, just go and get a good education and become a doctor or a solicitor or something. So that was always drilled into me from a young age. But I just didn't enjoy the secondary school. Well, one, obviously because of what was happening at school, but I just wanted to kind of do something on my own.
So what was the main catalyst for leaving?
My dad kept going into the school and saying about this the teacher, but they wouldn't do anything about it. So he pulled me out of school, and I went in to do home tutoring for a couple of months until they could find me get me into another school. And then in the meantime, I did go back to I went from public school to a private school in year 4. And then I went back into the home tutoring, and then tried to go back into a public school because I didn't want to go back to a private one. But I got bullied then. So I went there for one day and then got bullied because I'd been at a private school and people thought I was a snob sort of thing. So yeah, it was quite odd. So then I went back into home tutoring. So I actually ended up starting a second business when I was 13. And that kind of took over from school, really.
So what was your experience of home tutoring?
Yeah, it was okay. It was different, completely different, because you've got no friends with you. So that was the kind of major difference. But also you learn so much more because you've kind of got one-to-one attention, and it can be changed to suit you, if that makes sense, rather than when you're in a classroom, they're obviously trying to tailor it to 30 of you rather than one-on-one.
So how does it work? Do you have one tutor or do you have several tutors?
I had several ones. So I had like one that was focused on maths, then I had another one for science, another one for history, English, that sort of thing.
What were they all like? Like, are there any of those, of the home tutors that you had that stood out to you?
God, because I only did it for 3 months, didn't really, I didn't do it for very long. But yeah, there were some really good ones. I had a really good French and Spanish tutor. Actually, I actually found it enjoyable, so she stood out to me. She's quite local still. But in the end, I ended up setting up my own tutoring agency because I found a gap in the market where we were trying to find lots of different tutors for different subjects and trying to make it fit into like a school timetable. And it was just a nightmare because trying to get like tutors to fit back to back, and that was just proven to be an absolute nightmare. So basically I set up an agency which helped other people find tutors. So it was quite odd because some of my tutors ended up actually working for me.
Okay. Oh, brilliant. And that's, yes, and that still runs today as well.
Yes, that still runs today. Yeah, tutor magnet.
So if I look at my school friends and the ones who I kind of grew up and went to secondary school with, I always think of like those ones that didn't go to university as almost having like a 3-year head start in the world of work. So like if you kind of look at it that way, then you almost had like an 8-year head start on the world of work. Did it feel like that at the time when you were 12 or 13 starting businesses? Did you feel like, right, I'm really getting ahead in a different direction here?
Not at the time, no, because I found it was just a hobby really for me. It was always kind of one of those things that my dad kept saying, you're going to have to go back to school. So it was never a official kind of, I've left school now and I'm going to do business. It was more of a, it's just something to do whilst I'm waiting to go back to school really. Mm-hmm. Everyone always asks me, what's your hobbies? But actually business is my hobby, which is quite sad, but I enjoy it.
Yeah, absolutely fine. nothing wrong with that at all. So who did you have around you? Like when you were around 12 and 13, who were the five people that you like spent most time with?
My dad actually moved when I was 13. He moved to West Africa, Sierra Leone, for work. So we used to speak every day, but I didn't really see him for months at a time. That's when I moved in with my nan and granddad. So I'd say the five main people would be my nan, granddad, and probably my sister. Literally, I'd probably pick three.
What was the influence of all those people on you? Did they each teach you different things and each have like a different kind of way of looking at the world and of business?
So obviously my dad and my granddad's views were quite similar because they are both in business. My parents broke up when I was nine, so a few years before. And at the time it was, my mum actually went off with someone else. But at the time there was a lot of kind of anger towards that. But as I grew up, I realised that obviously it was a bad thing anyway, but to do. But my dad was always working. So it's kind of taught me that you need a work-life balance. And that's something that I'm not good at, but I'm trying a lot more with my own family now. I've got a little girl myself. So that taught me that work isn't everything. You've got to make time for your family. And then with my sister taught me that, because she's not in business or anything, but she taught me more of the more kind of keeping grounded, kind of how to do your washing, the house side of things.
Did you have to learn a lot of independence?
Yeah, so I was doing my own cooking, cleaning, washing, ironing when I was 14, yeah. So kind of learned a lot. You grow up quite fast. Everyone always used to say I could hold a conversation better with adults at 14 than I could with people my own age, because I'd kind of, having a year out after between 13 and 14, you kind of lose contact with your friends.
And I guess that probably feeds into the sales side of things, because if you're very confidently speaking to people, approaching people, negotiating, that's something a lot of much older and experienced adults can't necessarily get to grips with as well as you probably could have back then.
Yeah, exactly. And I think people never used to even question my age when I was going out pitching for sales, because they'd never have even thought that they were talking to a 14 or 15 year old.
Yeah, and I guess you didn't tell them.
No, I didn't tell them until I went on Dragon's Den, and obviously they found out. Then I was getting people ring me up saying, I never knew you were 18.
Oh, wow. Secrets out.
Yeah.
So when you were 13, that's when you moved in with your grandparents, and that's when you basically invented a solution to a problem that led to Grip-It.
Yeah, so basically I moved into their bungalow. It was only a small one, so they decided to convert their garage into a bedroom for me. They got all the work done, and literally the last job was to hang a curtain rail and a blind. So me and my granddad were trying to, well, getting all the bits ready. And my granddad said, look, I'm 74. I'll hold the ladder. You can go up and I'll tell you how to drill the holes and everything. So I went up there with a drill. I'd never even touched a drill before. And he was kind of saying, right, drill there, etc. And I just kept breaking drill bits after drill bits. And then went on to try. And once I finally got a hole, I was trying to get a fixing in to hang this curtain rail and then the blind, and just nothing would work. So we went down to Wix and bought every single fixing you could think of, and not one would work. He thought it was me, so he ended up getting up on the ladders himself. But he still couldn't do it. So we ended up going into his garden shed and basically playing around, just trying to find something that was just to bodge the job, really. So we... I knew I could get my little finger behind the wall. So I was kind of saying, look, if we can get something just to spread out, then that would kind of give it the security for us to hold something on the front of it. We ended up coming up with, it doesn't look nothing like what Grip-It does today, but we came up with a solution, basically a fixing that went in, hung the curtain around the blind, no problem at all.
So we still got the first version.
Yeah, I have, yeah. But that's been in the wall. But we kind of mocked it all out on a bit of, we cut up some, at the inner of a toilet roll with some drawing pins just to prove the like wings.
Oh, wow.
I've still got, yeah.
Wow, it must be so good to look at and look at where it started and what it is now and how many different countries it's in and everything.
It is mad, yeah, because it just goes so quick. You don't really realise, but we did after Dragon's Den, 2 years after, they did a Pitches to Riches. So they came around and kind of filmed where we created it, me and my granddad in the shed sort of thing. And it was only then when I actually had the time to even think back, because I think everyone always thinks that we've had some kind of laboratory in the garden, but it literally was just a garden shed.
So I think, I mean, it's one thing to find a problem, it's another thing to invent a solution for it, but then it's another to actually launch this solution to a market. So in launching it to the market then, considering that you are 13 at the time, what had to kind of all come into place in order for that to happen? Like, how did you feel like, yes, this is the right thing to do, I'm gonna make a go of it?
So it's about a couple of weeks after hanging the curtain rail and everything that I wanted to hang a TV on the wall. And obviously back then, I think it was a couple of £100 for the TV. Now it's thousands. I'd gone on Google and just went on all the forums to find out how other people do it. And there's pages and pages of people asking the same thing, kind of, I don't know how to hang a TV. I wish I could hang my TV on the wall. I can remember we were sat in my nan and granddad's garden on a swing, me and my granddad, and I just said, "This, we've really got something here." He said, "Look, I'm too old, I'm retired." And I said, "Well, look, I've got no GCSEs, I'm not going to school, I want to run with this, if you can just help me get it kind of developed." So he said, "Okay, well, there's two things I want. One is you need to get a patent, so protection on the product. And two is to promise him that I'd keep it made in the UK.
Okay.
So obviously I did. And then it took 4 years for us to actually get it from that stage to a actual product with full protection. So in 4 years, literally, I did all the marketing, all the packaging, getting all the suppliers, because it was difficult trying to find the suppliers, because you can imagine me turning up with my granddad, they probably thought we were having a laugh rather than taking it seriously. And then we actually launched it in 2012, and that's when we got the actual patent.
So in those meetings, if it was you turning up with your granddad, I can imagine that maybe it just worked in your favour, because they had that element of surprise and they thought, hang on, what's happening here? And then once you started speaking and they realised that you knew what you were talking about, then maybe that actually was more impactful because of the element of surprise at the start.
Yeah, it could be. I mean, no one ever said about the age or anything, and no one really ever said about it was weird me and my grand turning up. And we got some really good suppliers at the beginning, and some we still use because we built good relationships with them. But there was quite a few that you'd have the meeting with them and they'd never come back to you on a price or whatever. So I think they just kind of thought, no chance, this guy's never going to get anywhere. So we had a bit of that to begin with. But literally, yeah, we got it all ready to launch in the November of 2012. And I literally sent 400 sample packs with leaflets to all the big names like B&Q, Screwfix, etc. And then 4 days after, my nan's house phone rang and I answered just casually and said, "Hello." And they said, "Oh, is that a group of fixings?" And I said, "Speaking." And then it was the buyer for Screwfix. I need to get off my seat. So he invited me in for a meeting 2 weeks after, which is when we got our first order. So it happened really quickly.
So ahead of you and your granddad finding, like, kind of inventing something to solve a problem, what was your sort of day-to-day like with your granddad? Like, what were your conversation topics? Were you always making things together ahead of coming up with Grip It?
Yeah, we always used to, I mean, as even like with a younger kid, I used to spend a lot of time with them even before I lived with them. He used to tell me stories of all sorts of things from his past and mainly about his businesses and stuff. So we were always kind of talking about his history. And then we'd always kind of brainstorm and come up with little different ideas sort of thing. Some were just like kind of pipe dreams, but yeah, we've always done it even up just to now. Like, we'll go on a holiday on cruises or whatever, and we'll sit on the balcony and come up with a new idea near enough every time we go away.
What's your earliest memory of coming up with like a business idea or a product idea with your granddad?
It was probably around about 12. Yeah, when we went on a cruise, and I was on the cruise and I was doing some of my homework for the school. And I just said, "Well, wouldn't it be lovely if you had a ship? Like, you could go on a cruise ship and have a school." So basically then more for like sixth form age. So they could go on there, actually have their lessons on the ship, and then go off to different countries around the world and actually learn about the culture and the geography, history of it. That's when I kind of came up with the idea on the cruise. And then I spent probably a good 2 or 3 weeks basically turning it into a business plan. And it was quite exciting, actually. But it needed a lot of money to launch it, that was all.
That is such a cool idea, because you'd wake up in a different location every single morning. And then it'd be like, right, now we're going to explore. We're going to learn about the history of the place. We're going to actually see things. That'd be amazing.
Yeah, and people pay. And I was looking at like how much people pay for private schools, like some of the top private schools. And they pay £100,000 a year for their child to go to like Sweden or Eton, while they could pay a lot less than that and have their child travel the world.
So in planning out this kind of business, like, I mean, I'm guessing, so you haven't done it yet.
No, absolutely no.
Where does the main enjoyment for you come? Like, are you more of a kind of, you like coming up with the idea, planning it out, or are you more of a implementer, executor? Like, where do you get the most enjoyment?
It's the startup stage of anything. Startup is my kind of piece that I like. I like the creating of the idea and solving of a problem, but it's more about of actually making it, turn it into an actual product or reality. There's too many people, I think, that you speak to. And even when I was younger, you speak to them and go, oh, I invented that and 10 years ago, but I never did anything with it. And that kind of used to wind me up because I think, well, don't say it then because you didn't do it. So, I mean, I've had loads of people come up to me and say, oh, I invented something like the Grip It. I'm like, well, you didn't do anything about it, did you? So that kind of drives me really to enjoy that bit, really, actually making something of what you've come up with.
Yeah, so let's imagine someone had invented like Grab It and they'd come up with it and you were kind of calling up suppliers and trying to get stocked and they were like, nah, sorry, we've heard about this Grip It, but actually we use Grab It and it's better and et cetera, like, and you couldn't get anywhere. What would your alternative life look like? What would you be doing now if it wasn't for Grip It?
I don't know. Obviously, I still had the tutoring business at the time, which I've still got now, but I could have grown it a lot more. I had bigger plans with that than obviously things happen at the moment because Grip It took priority. I get bored quite easily, so I'm always looking at different things. So I'd have probably just got to end up doing something else. You never know, I might have had a shit now with loads of children.
Well, yeah. Yeah. That needs to happen in the future. That's got to happen, or someone needs to. Yeah. Have you seen online you get steal this idea forums where people just write cool business ideas that they've had and get other people to roll with them?
Oh, no, I haven't seen that. That's quite good.
Yeah, I could pop it on one of those. Or you basically just tweet it with the hashtag steal this idea and then get someone to roll with it.
Oh, okay. I might have a look at that later.
What about when it's not going so well, or what about when you're hitting like challenging times? Say even like when you were growing up, was there ever a point where you just thought, yeah, this kind of route I'm going down just isn't for me?
Well, yeah, I think all the time you're always going to hit. I mean, business is not easy at all. So I think everyone always sees that. I like the picture of the iceberg. I'm not sure if you've ever seen it, where basically people only see what's on the top of the water, but they don't see what's going on below. I've got that in my office, actually, that image. But basically, that's very true. There's a lot of hard work to go into what you get out of it. So my challenges mainly have been down to finding the right staff, because no one's going to care about your product and your business as much as you do, because obviously it's your business. And I found it really difficult to find people around me that get as excited about it as me, that you can trust and believe in. So yeah, I think I'd say my biggest challenge has been finding the right people around me. And yeah, and then after that, I'd say the biggest challenges any business is going to face is funding for growth plans. Because just as you think you've got enough money to kickstart the business, something else always crops up, or you get a big order and you've got to then fund that order. So you're constantly having to change the way you're running everything to make it work.
So when you are going through challenging times, is there anyone's advice who you channel, or is there anything that anyone said to you that you think about when you're going through tough times?
I mean, Dad always said when he was younger, because I was used to kind of question him about work, he was kind of, if it was easy, everybody would be doing it. And everyone always uses that. That's really cheesy, but it is very true. And I always use that even now when something goes wrong. I'm just like, well, and my managers are kind of kicking off. I'm like, well, if it was easy, everyone would be doing it and we wouldn't have a job. So I always say that, and the other one is like, nothing gets handed to you on a plate, so you do literally have to go out there and fight for it. And I mean, there's times now when I go to customers and I am fighting for the business, because we want the business, sort of thing. So you can't wait around all the time and let people come to you.
So you said you've got a daughter who is just under one.
Yeah, she's 9 months old now, bless her.
So, I mean, she's got 12 years before she has to start a business of her own.
I know, no pressure.
Yeah. So have you given much thought to the sort of role model that you want to be for your daughter when she's growing up?
For me, it's times more important for my daughter, because although I didn't have a horrible upbringing, my dad wasn't around. Obviously, my parents split up and I don't speak to my mum. So for me, it's kind of a way up of the fact that, yeah, it's nice to have nice things and everything, but time is more important. So my whole thing about starting business young and doing the best as I could young was so that when I start a family, I can actually have weekends off, enjoy the evening. So for me, my biggest thing I want to be a role model is time that she can, I don't know, I can take her out on the weekends. I can pick her up from school if I want to. So that's my kind of biggest thing. And really, she can pick what she wants to do, because everyone is different. She might love school and want to go to uni. She might notch. You might want to go out and go and work at McDonald's. It doesn't really matter to me. So
I think I read somewhere when I was researching that you said looking after a baby was much harder than running a £20 million business.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, Laura, my other half, she kept saying to me, it's so tough, because obviously I'm at work in the day and I get home and she said, I'm knackered. And I was like, are you sure? I said, I'm having to run multiple businesses and that. And yeah, anyway, we went on a cruise for 2 weeks last month. And yeah, definitely, it's definitely harder.
If you could kind of go back to your former self, to your like 11-year-old or 12-year-old self, would you have any advice for them that you kind of wish that you'd known at the time?
A big thing for me, because I go to do a lot of school talks, is that to have an open mind, basically, and that anything is possible. And that I do, does mean anything. It doesn't matter if you've got money, your family've got money, or if you've got absolutely nothing. If you want something hard enough and you're prepared to give it everything, you can achieve it. And whether that is going to uni, going to get a job and work your way up, start your own business. Everyone's different. And I think there's too much pressure at schools to kind of do well, and that's the only way you're going to succeed. But that isn't for everybody.
So that anything is possible is so interesting, because in the other podcasts that we've done, a lot of the other guests have had that mindset, that anything is possible mindset. And it's normally been someone who's really, really drilled that into them. So is that the experience that you had from your dad and your granddad? Is that the kind of main crux of what they kind of taught you?
Yeah, I think so, because they both had nothing when they both started. So it's kind of growing up, seeing that and hearing about that kind of shows you that it can be done. And why not? At the end of the day, you only live once. So you might as well, you don't want to look back. I don't want to look back in another 30, 40 years and go, oh, I wish I'd tried that. Because I don't want to be one of those people that go, oh, I invented the Grip-It 20 years ago, but no one ever did anything about it. And especially when you're young, I always say young people have got the biggest opportunity, because they haven't got a mortgage, they haven't got kids to provide for. You can have a bit more of a risk in starting a business, because if it all goes wrong, you can go back and live with your parents, sort of thing. It's not like you've got a whole family to provide for.
And did you have a sense of that at the time?
No, not at the time. When I was, as it was kind of growing, probably when I was 15, 16, obviously I had to take on more risk. At that point, you kind of think, actually, I'm a lot better off now than I would have been at 30, 40, when if I knew I had to kind of pay the mortgage at the end of the month, where I could have actually put that into stock, then it was a lot easier when I was younger.
Yeah, definitely. Because if your accommodation's sorted, because you're young enough to be kind of for that to be allowed to happen, and then it is like you might have your phone bill to pay for, or you might have your sort of your snacks and you're going out with your friends at the weekend. But that's sort of it.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, I think that's the benefit that we've got as young people.
What are the main influences? Like, what are the main reasons for your success? If you had to put it down to like three main things,
I would say the kind of can-do attitude. I don't give up. So basically, even when I get tough times and something knocks me back for sick, the next day I'm back up and I'm going again. So that's probably one. Two would be, I've always been one of those people that I quite like listening to people. And I've been in meetings with people where they've just non-stop talked about their whole life and it's all about them, which people find annoying. But I quite like it because you can hear about their success, their failures, what they did wrong. I used to, when I was younger, read a lot of books. Like, I've read most of the Dragon's books, Richard Branson's books, just because I like to see where they've gone wrong. I focus more on where they've gone wrong, so I can kind of make sure I don't do that in my own business. So that, I'd say, helps a lot. And then three, not to be afraid of getting things wrong. I like making mistakes just as much as I like reading about people's mistakes, because I know that it won't happen again. And every time I make a mistake, it improves things.
So not only learning from your own mistakes, but then learning from other people's mistakes so you don't have to make them yourself.
Yeah. But it takes a bit. It takes someone to actually, it's a different person for someone actually to learn from other people's mistakes. Because I think there's too many people that don't want to listen to other people and learn from other people or read books because they think they're better than everyone else. But no, but you're not, sort of thing.
So have you ever taken any advice that wasn't the right thing to do? Or have you ever kind of learned from someone's mistake, which actually turned out to mean a mistake for you as well?
Not so much as in mistakes. I think I've made lots of mistakes in terms of it's the staffing side of the business. I keep going back to that, but that's been a huge challenge for me because I've read people say, oh, when you get to a certain level, hire people that have already been within the industry. Mm-hmm. But that's never turned out right for me. We've had two people that I hired from the industry, both left within 3 months. So it doesn't necessarily work for everybody, but I think your eyes are a lot more open when you've seen other people's mistakes or heard about them, because then you can start to, I could have had this, one of the guys working for me for a couple of years before I noticed that there was a problem yet, because I knew what other people had gone through. I managed to kind of iron that out within 3 months.
So who supported you when you first started, like hiring people and interviewing and doing all the stuff associated with growing?
Well, the first two people I hired were actually my friends, because when we used to make Grippets, we used to make them around the dining table. My friends were still at school, so I used to pick them up from school and they'd come and help me make them. And I always promised them that there'd be a job in it for them. So those were the two people I hired first. And then people outside of that was kind of, it was just kind of me. But I suppose my dad was overseas in Africa, so I was ringing him kind of saying, what kind of person do I need? So yeah, me doing the interviews, really. I was just quite lucky.
What, can you remember the first one?
Yeah, production manager. So I had to find someone to help me run a load of machines that we just bought. I didn't even know how to run them myself, really. So first of all, I had to meet with the suppliers of the machines to kind of get an understanding myself, because I thought if I go into an interview with someone, they're going to just pull the wool over my eyes. So I found out more about the machines and what we needed, and then the kind of person that they would recommend. And then I was really lucky. The first person who came for the job got it, and he's still here now. So Simon, he basically came on as kind of production manager. He was like, yeah, employee number three.
So is your style to kind of lean towards the trusting side or lean towards the skeptical side?
I trust everyone to a point, and I don't trust anyone explicitly, basically. Mm-hmm. That's my kind of rule. Everyone needs to earn respect and trust. Everyone gets a bit of trust for free, if that makes sense, and then they have to build on that. So there's some people in the business I trust with a lot. Some people I wouldn't trust them as far as they could walk out the door, sort of thing. So it's all varies with me. Everyone's got a chance, I think, because everyone makes mistakes as well. So you've got to kind of be, you've got to be fair but firm when you need to be.
So where did that come from then? Like, what experience when you were growing up led to your sort of ethos on managing people and on hiring people?
So one thing, my dad had his business up in Bristol when I was younger, and I used to go there quite a lot. Everyone always said, oh, we love you, your dad's great, he's a lovely guy, sort of thing. And I always used to say to my dad, are they just trying to kind of suck up to you, or do they actually think that? And he said, oh, well, I don't know. He said, but I was kind of saying, well, what do you do for them that a normal boss doesn't do? And he used to say that if they need to go somewhere for their child's dentist appointment or whatever, or their own dentist appointment, then he lets them go, because he said, and he doesn't watch their hours or count their hours, but he trusts them and they trust him, which means that if he needs a favour one day, they don't mind coming in an hour early or doing the extra bit for him. Same thing where I know the few times before where one of them's had a car accident and couldn't afford to go and get another car for 300 quid. He'd lent them the 300 quid and they paid it back over 10 weeks. But that earns people's, that means the company's really earned that person's trust, sort of thing. And yes, you get bitten a few times, I think, but I think as long as you're kind of, you go into it knowing you're going to get bitten a few times, you'll get a lot more out of the people that actually do benefit from it and do kind of give it back to you.
Well, it sounds like you've emulated that strategy within Grippit.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I have a complete open door policy. If they've got a problem, then they can come and talk to me about it. I can't always solve it, but I always think that we're here to help them, really. So they're part of a family. It's a Grippit family, I call it.
Back when you were younger, you had a kind of view of the world of work from dad, granddad, and people around you. Did you have a view of success and what success would look like for you when you were older, maybe?
My dad made quite a lot of money at one point, and then the recession hit, so he ended up going over to Sierra Leone to grow another business he was involved in. But so at the time when I was growing up, he got a nicer hat, bigger house, and like you can see nicer things, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So then when the recession kicked in, things got a lot tighter, smaller house, etc. So I've seen a blip of success, and then I've seen kind of how it could have gone if it went really bad, sort of thing. So it definitely grounded me. But yeah, I think for me, when I was a kid, success for me was just to have my own house. So I really wanted my own house before I was 21. And I can remember saying to my dad, I definitely want my own house before I was 21. And he said, all right, steady on. Anyone who's quite young. But yeah, I'd always been very focused on my own house, and I want to be able to get my own furniture in it, sort of thing.
Well, has your view of success changed now?
I think now it's more about the time, which is weird. I think everyone focuses more on material things, especially when you kind of start out, because it's nice to have a nice car, it's nice to have a nice house. But for me, it's more about time and flexibility. So to be able to know that if I wanted to sell Gripit tomorrow, I could, or if I wanted to go on holiday for 2 weeks, I could, and it wouldn't affect the business, or just being able to have a bit more flexibility in life and not be solely reliant on your income that you get from your business or your employee. I think it's more about, just having a bit more freedom, really.
And then I guess having a baby as well, and how your priorities change around that, because it just, you're not the centre of your own kind of universe anymore.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's what's changed everything, really. And like I said, I'm not there yet with the freedom or the kind of work-life balance, but I'm definitely working on it.
So finally then, any words of wisdom that you'd pass on to aspiring entrepreneurs? Because when I was researching as well, I thought it was really interesting that you offer a grant or like a prize to someone who's under the age of 16 who has got a business idea that they want to roll with. So alongside kind of supporting in that way, is there any advice that you'd give to someone who was looking to start their own business?
Yeah, I think anyone who's looking to start their own business should start looking at reading some books, successful people's books. So I'd go for the best book I've ever read, actually, is Duncan Ballantyne's book called Riding the Storm. And obviously Duncan Ballantyne was a dragon, he's not anymore, but it's a really honest book of where he'd made a lot of money, he was very successful, and then he nearly lost it all. But he was very honest in his book about the kind of challenges that he kind of had and faced. And I think that's a very good book, because not many people are as honest as he is, sort of thing, and that kind of you learn a lot from that. But yeah, I think literally listen and learn from successful people, really, and then that will give you inspiration. Obviously, it won't give you the funding and everything, but that's why I've got the enterprise scheme that I've started for under 16s to hopefully, it gives them a chance to win 30,000. But apart from that, it's trying to get them thinking about ideas and thinking that school's not the only option.
Jordan, thank you so much for joining us today. Where can people find out more about you?
So my website is jordandakin.co.uk. So I've got everything on there about me. I've just launched my first autobiography at 22, I know. But that's now available on Amazon for next day delivery. And that's called Gripped.
Gripped. Okay, brilliant. Thank you so much.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
This episode was brought to you by Clever Tykes Children's Storybooks. If you want to support the podcast and help share our ethos of inspiring, enterprising behaviour, head over to clevertykes.com and order a set of the storybooks to give to a child that you know.